Please to the court, Richard Hendrickson, I represent the appellants in this matter. And I think our arguments are very, very simple. This is a simple, simple case. And the Minnesota statutes are very specific, and they are totally applicable in this situation. This is not a uncommon problem at all. The will that's in contention is unambiguous. The district court, the probate court agreed with that. The other side agreed with that. All the parties agree that the will speaks for itself. It's unambiguous. The only question is, what does it mean? Period. How do you interpret the will? And in this case, the parties have basic standard wills, and they had no children. They've been married for a long time. They got divorced 2 years past, and then the deceased died. The controlling statutes are 524-2804, resolution, revocation of the provisions in a will dealing with a divorce. And it's very, very clear, absolutely clear. The provision in controversy is determined as though the ex-spouse predeceased the deceased.
Mr. Hendrickson, how do we balance the case law and the statutory direction that we're supposed to determine the intent at the time the will is executed versus this provision in the statute about in the event of a dissolution? I mean, the 2804.
Trying to ascertain the intent of the deceased at the time of the execution of the will. Had they known about the fact that they might get divorced? I think that case is, there's a number of cases predating Danka, which supports the position that you just look at the plain meaning of the will. Look at the Cosgrove case.
Well, then, do we look at the plain meaning and just look at that? And then what role does the statute? Because I thought you were arguing that the statute dictates the result here. Because I'll tell you, I don't think the will itself is clear. I mean, my wife, there is no wife. So at the time he died, and then you do have at the end the name of the wife and that's who's intended. So what are we to be guided by? The will itself, or we can't tell from the will, so therefore we're going to look to the statute.
The statute, well, first of all, the will identifies the wife by name. That is the wife. Even though the wife is no longer technically his wife, she's still the named individual in the will. The will's provision, I think, is 3.4 or whatever, basically says in the event that my wife doesn't survive me, and under 524-2804, she's considered to have predeceased him, then it goes in equal shares to his heirs at law and to her heirs at law. And 524-2508, I think, is also very important in that it says that except as stated in 804, a change of circumstances does not revoke the will or any part of it.
Mr. Hendrickson, I'm going to, unless you weren't finished, I want to follow up with a question Judge Siegel just asked so I can understand better as well. your heading, one of your first headings in your brief is that a clear reading of 804, I'm just gonna use the 804, means your client receives. But isn't it true that only answers half of the question? In other words, it only addresses revocation of former spouse's interest. Am I not correct? And hence, we don't yet, by looking at that statute alone, have resolution of the issue your clients raise. We must then look to the provisions of the will. So both the statute and the will then come into play. Am I correct in that? Or if I'm not, can you explain what you meant in that portion of your brief?
Yeah, the will itself, I think, is very, very clear and very clean. And it says that my wife, and it's identified specifically, Sarah, takes, okay? And if she dies, if she predeceases me, then because we had no children, then the will clearly says half goes to my heirs, half goes to Sarah's heirs. And then the statute comes into play, 804, Sarah is presumed dead for that purpose. I think a very, very strong analogy would be, what if, in fact, they didn't get divorced? And in this case, the wife predeceased the decedent. Clearly, her heirs, Sarah's heirs, would be identified. And in this case, it would be her parents under the statute. So the clear, clean will says Sarah gets my estate. If Sarah dies before I do, then I divide my estate equally between my heirs and her heirs. That's what the will says. Okay, and the fact they got divorced, then the statute 804 says, okay, Sarah is presumed dead. Everything else continues on as though she had died. So I think the clearest, quickest analogy is, yeah, we treat the will as though they were married and Sarah died, okay? And I think it's abundantly clear. And like the Cosgrove case, which was mentioned in the briefs. And in construing a will, the cardinal rule is that the testator's intention is to be gathered from the language of the will itself. Conversely, intention which a testator may have had but did not express in the will cannot be considered.
So can I ask you a hypothetical? So what if the will did not provide for half of the estate going to wife's heirs at law? So the wife is mentioned just as it is in this, and wife dies, would wife's parents, I mean, you know, divorce, but she did predecease him regardless. What? Would they have a claim then or not?
No, because the will is abundantly clear. If there was no provision that said, if my wife predeceases me, then to half to my estate, half to her or my heirs, half to her heirs. If it didn't have that provision, we wouldn't be here. Because the statute again says she's dead, period. And we would not be here. This would not be an issue. So I think the will is very clear. The statutes are clear. And legislative intent, the statutes control. The situation in analyzing this will is, okay, what if Sarah is dead? assuming Sarah's dead. That's it. And all the other provisions of the will apply.
So, Mr. Hendrickson, I'm wondering if you're familiar with the Uniform Probate Code provisions that parallel this statute. They are a little bit different. Are you familiar with that?
I'm somewhat familiar with it, Your Honor, yes.
Well, as I understand them, they actually do more than revoke the divorced spouse's provisions in a will as a divorced spouse, but also affect provisions that relate to relatives of a divorced spouse. Is that your understanding too?
No, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand why the probate court would actually.
No, I'm talking about the Uniform Probate Code. I'm not talking about Minnesota statute. And I'm just curious if you're familiar with that and would comment on it. If you're not, I'm not trying to. Yeah,
I'm only familiar with Minnesota's probate code. Okay. And I'm not familiar with that code somehow contradicting the statutes.
Well, Mr. Hendrickson, let me dovetail from Judge Bradfield's question. Let's assume that 804 does not exist. There is no revocation of a former spouse's, which basically, as I understand it, legislatively reads into a otherwise unambiguous will, a no longer intent to give to her. What would, under that scenario, absent that statute, be her claim upon his death? And why?
Excuse me, Sarah's claim or her heir's claim? It would be Sarah's claim?
Yes, okay. Because Sarah's we claim. Know that she's only fictitionally predeceased because of that statute. My question is, absent any part of the Uniform Probate Code that has a revocation provision, what would be her claim? What basis?
She would have a spousal claim. And there's a whole series of various claims regarding the homestead. The first 75,000, I can't remember, first X amount of dollars of the probate assets.
Is that post dissolution though?
I was presupposing that all the same facts, but absent the revocation, they're divorced, but we don't have the revocation. What would be the basis of her claim, if any, in that scenario?
In that situation, she would argue, I think her argument would be that she's still named in the will. If he did not want her in the will, he should have destroyed it. And it's very, very easy to disclaim the will. Simply, he could have torn it up. He could have written a new will. He could have applied a letter or something like that stating he didn't want her in the will.
So that brings me back to my first question. Do we look at just the will? Because you're saying it's unambiguous and that's all we should look at. Or does this, regardless of what the intent was, even if Mr. Tomczyk had intended, I don't care if, you know, we've been divorced for, you know, 90% of the time, I want her to inherit from me if I die, that we would still look at the statute.
I think you would look at the statute unless he specifically tried to override that after the divorce, some sort of a letter or something like that.
So then the will itself is not clear, I think. I don't know. At any rate, go ahead. I'm thinking out loud here. So just, yeah, you go ahead.
Yeah, and trying to determine his intent, Mr. Tomczyk's intent, what if he had known kind of a thing. There's no provision in the will addressing that. And you're looking at the basic terms of the will itself. And there's a whole series of cases that we've cited in our brief, you know, that points to looking at the basic terms, the wording in the will itself. That's what applies. And that the court is not to speculate as to what would have his intent be had he known that 15 years from now, we're going to get divorced. You look at the basic fundamental wording in the will. If there's no ambiguity, that applies. I I think that's just a absolute fundamental part of the analysis. What's the basic wording in the will? Trying to speculate what he wants. He didn't put anything down. 2 years went by and he didn't change, after the divorce, he didn't change the will. That's also an indication of perhaps of his intent.
All right, thank you. I was gonna call you Mr. Cole, but Mr. Hendrickson. Mr. Morley, if I'm pronouncing your name correctly,
that
proceed
is correct,
when
Honor.
You're ready. Okay, good, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Morley. I represent the respondent, Michael Tomczyk. Michael Tomczyk is the petitioner below and also the brother of the decedent, Matthew Tomczyk. Your Honors, the only issue we have to answer here today is whether at the time he executed his will, Matthew Tomczyk intended to devise to Sarah Headley's parents if he and Sarah divorced before his death. And the answer is no, and there's three bases for that. First, the unambiguous language of the will. Second, support in a prior persuasive opinion by this court in the Danka case. And third, support in outside jurisdiction authority. And I would point this court particularly to the Harmon case of the California Court of Appeals, which is relied upon by this court in its Danka opinion. We ask that this court affirm the lower court's order. The lower court correctly found that there was no intent to devise to an ex-spouse's parents in the language of this will.
Mr. Morley, can I ask you, first, my question, 524.2-508, except as provided, makes reference to except as provided in 804, which is the one we're referring to, as well as 803. A change of circumstances does not revoke a will or any part of it. How do we read that other than when combined with everybody's agreement that the will is unambiguous? Mm-hmm. The referee found that, your client argues, everybody says it's unambiguous. Then we look at the terms of this will and its wording. Am I correct? That's the only basis upon which I think Harmon refers to this and all the courts do to read intent. We just read the words in the will that's in front of us that everybody says is unambiguous. So am I correct by that statute? The only provision in the will that's revoked upon his death is to his former spouse. And we are presuming she's predeceased. So now we look at the residual clause, which everybody's looked at, and the words in that clause to determine intent. Am I correct?
I think you're correct on every part of that. I don't think the statute impacts the question at issue here. On the first hand, you're correct that this is unambiguous. And Danka and Harmon both say that with wills that are similar and states that have similar statutes. What we have here, though, is a situation where even though the particular provision that says my wife's heirs at law is not revoked, that is a gift to a class which has now become non-existent upon the divorce of the decedent and Sarah Headley.
Can you clarify that? Because I'm assuming they exist. They might even be listening to our conversation today. Yep. We know who Sarah Headley is because she's identified in the will and all references in this will to wife is her. Am I correct about that? So you could replace wife with her or interchange it because it's her and she has heirs of which I believe there's no dispute who they are. So tell me how they no longer exist when we look at the words of this will, when everybody says the will is unambiguous.
Yeah. Your Honor, I'd point you to the Harmon case. And this is, like I said, a case out of California. Danka relies upon it. And the particular importance of that case is the distinction between a gift to a class, which is, I think the class there is my spouse's children. That's the language in Harmon. And then a gift to a particular individual, such as in the Kerr case, which is relied upon by the appellants here, where there's a named person who has a descriptor. In that case, it was my stepchild, Don Valentine. So in the Harmon line of cases where it's a gift to a class, Harmon found of particular importance a fact that we have here also. The people who were named in the will in Harmon were only named in the preamble. So it was the husband named with the husband's four children that were brought into the marriage. But the operative language, the court said, of the will only referred to my spouse's children and did not refer to those people specifically by name. And they said that that showed that the testator had a paramount intent to only give if that class of persons existed at the time of the decedent's death. And because of the divorce in that case, that class of persons no longer existed. And that's exactly what we have here.
Yes, are you aware, Mr. Morley, of any Minnesota decision that has espoused that premise?
Well, the Danka court dealt with facts that are nearly identical. Danka involved the daughter, trying to get this right here. Yeah, Danka was one half unto the heirs at law of my husband. And Danka followed the rationale of the Harmon court in saying that the only intent shown by this will, and it's important to note that intent is to be determined at the time the will is executed.
Can I ask you, Mr. Murley, I believe it's the quote from the Cosgrove will case that refers to it. A cardinal rule is that the testator's intention is to be gathered from the language of the will itself. Conversely, intention which the testator may have had but did not express in his will cannot be considered. It seems to me you're making an argument of the Cosgrove has made clear we don't consider, and that is this legislature did as to the ex-spouse, but no one else, and that is we will presume his intent at the time of will is no longer his intent today because they divorced. And yet the cardinal rule, according to Cosgrove, is we just look at the words and presume the intent as articulated by those words. Are you aware of any case law that would allow us to go when a will is unambiguous and everybody here is claiming it is, that we do look at anything other than the words written in that will?
Yeah. Yes. The Hartman case in Minnesota gives a general rule that not only says, do we look at the words of the will, we look at the circumstances under which the will was executed at the time it was executed. And I want to be very clear. I am not making an argument that we're looking at any intent beyond the date of the execution of the will. And to answer your question about whether there is case law, yes, both Harmon and Danka both directly address this issue.
But I didn't read Hartman the same way. And a quote Hartman also cites from the Silverstone's will, which was a 1943 case, that if there is no ambiguity or equivocation when the will is read as a whole, extrinsic evidence is not admissible. And so the only way I assume one could discern intent other than the words would be if people argued, if your client or if the objectors argued it was ambiguous, and now we want to bring in evidence.
So I'll point you
to trying to get at how would we get to the intent other than the words if there's no extrinsic evidence because everyone's arguing it's unambiguous.
Yep. I'm going to point you to the passage I'm referring to in Hartman, which is on page 482 to 483. The purpose of the court in construing a will is to ascertain the actual intention of the testator as it appears from a full and complete consideration of the entire will when read in light of the surrounding circumstances at the time of the execution of the will. So I would agree there is no extrinsic evidence that is admissible if you have an unambiguous will like we have here. But that's where I was pointing to both Harmon and Danka. Harmon and Danka highlight that the intent of a will in this circumstance, which is a will that is signed during a marriage, the only intent is that the parties remain married and death ends the marriage.
Can I clarify? But in Hartman, the judge and the appellate court, Supreme Court, all agreed it was ambiguous. So are you aware of any case law where a will everybody agreed was unambiguous that we can look at, quote unquote, surrounding circumstances to read and understand an unambiguous will?
Yes, the Danka case. The Danka case takes into account the surrounding circumstance that when the will was signed, the parties were married. And the fact that they were married shows that the intent was for the estate to be split in half when the surviving spouse passes away, there having been no divorce or annulment of the marriage prior to the deaths of the two parties.
Our court in Danka determine, I don't remember seeing the words, maybe it's implied that the will in question was ambiguous?
No, I do not believe they made a determination that the will was ambiguous. That was not a part of the Danka opinion. So that was also not a part of the Herman opinion, the California court, which came to the same conclusion. And I can read you a phrase from the Herman opinion, which shows that the intent, which is assumed by law, by the court in that situation, is that the parties did not consider any gifts to an ex-spouse's heirs. And that court says on page 1527, the will lacks any specific provision with respect to marital dissolution, and there is no reason to believe he gave any thought to that possibility at the time of execution. So Harmon goes on to say that the only intent shown by the will here is to give to the particular people at issue, my spouse's children, if that class of people still exists at the time of the death of the decedent. But that class of people is just simply non-existent upon the divorce of the decedent and the ex-spouse. And we have the same situation here. So I think if this court is looking to articulate a distinction between the Kerr line of cases relied upon by the appellants here and the Danka line of cases, it's that it's the difference between a gift to a class, which can cease to exist at a point in time if that class, if the description of that class is no longer relevant, such as my wife's heirs at law, when there's no longer a wife and it's now an ex-wife. We'd have to read into that a provision that says the will gives to an ex-wife's heirs at law. And then on the other side, when it's an individual named with a descriptive term, that may not apply anymore, but it's an individual identified by name. That's the distinction here.
Mr. Morley, I'm taking it from your argument, I thought so on the brief and today, and that it matters not, in your opinion, that she is named in the will and all reference hereafter or above is to her. But my question is this, let's assume then, rather than use wife, it uses her name, which the will, as I read it, it's interchangeable. So she does exist, and they divorce, and her interest is revoked. Would her heirs at law still be extinguished, even though it says to Sarah Headley and doesn't reference wife, but they were married and now they're divorced, and hence the revocation, we go to them. Would that make a difference in your opinion? Yes. As to how we should read the will and why?
Yes, it would make a difference, and that's the crux of the Harmon case, by pointing out the difference between individuals being named in the operative language of the will versus in a preamble or in the definition section like we have here. If, for instance, the will in our case, section 3.4 said one half to my heirs at law and one half to Sarah Headley's heirs at law, this case is very different, and I think there would be a taking. But the fact that it was chosen to identify this class only by relationship to a person who now doesn't fit the description of wife shows that this class is no longer in existence. And I think it'd be even clearer.
Mr. Morley, I just have to stop you briefly because I'm struggling with that distinction, and maybe you can help me out. We don't have a reference to Sarah Headley in a preamble provision. We have it in the general governing provisions in Article 7. And 7.1.1 is pretty sweeping in its language. It says, my wife's name is Sarah Tomczyk, and all references in this will to my wife or my spouse are to her only. So it's very personal and specific. And in light of that, don't we have to do what Judge Slater was just saying? We have to import Sarah's name to this residual clause. In reading the will, that appears to be the testator's intent at the time the instrument was executed. And I'm struggling to see, I mean, you're not claiming ambiguity, but I'm struggling to see the ambiguity or the way in which you're trying to cabin it by saying only while we're married. That's not what 7.1.1 says.
Yeah. Well, I would again relate to the Herman case out of California, where it was very specifically, and the people who were supposed to take in that case were also identified by name, which we don't have here. Calvin and Patricia Headley are not identified by name anywhere in this will. And even in that case, where that will identified each of the people who claimed to take under it by name, the fact that their names were not used in the operative language was determinative to that court. that that was a class gift. And if the class did not meet the description in the operative language, there was no taking. And that's, that is what we have here. I do understand every will is different and the language here is not verbatim what Herman is, but I still think it shows a conscious decision not to include Sarah's name in the provisions, the operative provisions of the will itself. And that, that still lines up with the intent found by the court in Herman, in Danka, in those line of cases. And it clearly distinguishes this case from Kerr, where somebody is named individually, despite a descriptive term that's only accurate at the time the will is executed and not at the time of the decedent's death. So with that, I thank you and respectfully ask that this court's order be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morley. Mr. Hendricks, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. In a provision in the Kerr case, citing the Dysel case from 1972, they say the terms husband and wife are descriptive terms. They are not limitations. So I think one of our arguments would be they're describing the wife as Sarah, but it's not limiting the terms of the will to the fact that she's still her or his wife when he dies. It's just descriptive, just identifying who the wife is at that time. It's just simply Sarah. And a devise to a class is recognized constantly in wills and in the probate court to my heirs, to my to the good buddies of my bowling club, for example. A class is not a nullity at all. And the Danka case, I found confusing.
Mr. Hendrickson, a class is determined, the membership of a class is determined, right, when the will
correct.
Is actually probated, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. And so here, I think the issue that Mr. Morley is raising is at the time that this will is being interpreted and enforced during probate, there is no wife, right?
That is
so that
correct.
The class itself doesn't exist. It would be like making a bequest to my children and at the time that the testator dies, all the children have predeceased. The class would no longer exist.
But in this
so,
case-
help me out, why does it exist?
I'm a little confused with your question. I apologize. Can you ask it again, please?
Sure. I'm just saying, I think we agree that that Minnesota law is clear. You determine membership of a class at the time the will is interpreted and enforced, you know, during probate. Right now, so this will gives, you know, the operative language is talking about giving to the wife, my wife's heirs at law. There's no membership in that class because Mr. Tomczyk, the testator, at the time of his death, had no wife, no wife. So except, nobody belongs to that class. So is it ambiguous? Is it unenforceable because no one belongs to the class? You know, Mr. Morley is saying it's not enforceable because no one belongs to the class. And I just haven't heard your answer. Maybe you gave it and I just missed it.
Okay. I think the statute 804 specifically applies to that on how that should be interpreted. It's interpreted as though she predeceased Mr. Tomczyk. That's how that clause is to be interpreted pursuant to this plain meaning of the statute. Okay. In the case of a divorce, the former spouse shall be presumed predeceased per the term of the will. The statute is, in my opinion, my argument is abundantly clear that 804 applies and you apply it as though they were married, but that she predeceased him. And then under 508, all the other provisions of the will remain intact. I think those statutes, if you read those, and they are very precise, and it was created to address this kind of a situation. And a class does exist because it only assumes that the wife has died. Okay, that's the assumption, that the wife, in this case, predeceased Mr. Tomczyk. Okay, if they had been married and she had predeceased him, there'd be no doubt whatsoever how the case would be divided, how his estate would be divided between his heirs and her heirs. And that's what the statutes say. And I believe that the court should apply the statutes in the plain meaning, because that should control. Very quickly, I see I'm almost out of time, but I want to reinforce the respondent's precedential opinion. I think a court's opinion in this matter would be extremely important.
Mr. Hendricks, you are out of time. So thank you very much to both of you for your arguments. And I think we'll proceed to our third case. This case is now submitted, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time period.